Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for August 7th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, making twisted and curved shapes from DNA, new technologies for testing the toxicity of chemicals, and the latest in our year-long Origin series. This time, the origin of eukaryotes. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how happy the internet is, from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Making nanorobots and other nano or micro-sized machines is still largely the stuff of science fiction. But in a paper in this week's Science, William Shih and colleagues report a key advance in working with DNA that will help in constructing such nanoscale devices. They have folded DNA into twisted and curved nanoscale shapes to create objects that look like toothed gears, wireframe balls, and even coiled springs like the ones you might see inside a wristwatch. Scientists had previously approximated curved objects by attaching small straight segments of DNA together, but now with a true curve, researchers doing nanoconstruction have greater control over the exact position of the DNA molecules, which is important if the gears and other parts of future nano devices are to fit together. I spoke with Shih from his office at Harvard University.
Macro technology is dependent on our ability to shape material to create almost any shape that we want in order to build devices. And we're trying to do the same thing on the nanometer scale. And in particular, we're using DNA self-assembly in order to achieve that end. On the macro scale, I think there's this idea of top-down production, where we start with, let's say, in sculpture, we start with a solid block of some material, and then typically we might whittle away that material until we get to a final shape. But on the molecular level, oftentimes that doesn't work so well. What works better is this idea of self-assembly, where we have a bunch of small parts that are floating around in solution, bumping into each other. And then eventually, sometimes when they bump into each other in the way that we want them to, they don't let go. And through many cycles of this bumping into each other and sticking, eventually we end up with the desired shape if we've programmed the structure of the molecules correctly.
Now, I understand that this is building off of previous work of your team published earlier this year in which you all constructed three-dimensional honeycomb lattices of DNA strands. How do you give a bend or a twist to a honeycomb lattice of DNA?
Yeah, so the way that we do that, the example for bending is much easier to understand. So if you imagine that our honeycomb lattice is actually a honeycomb lattice of springs, and what if on one side of this bed of springs, what we're doing is we're actually tightening the springs. So we're effectively cutting out sections of the springs and then reconnecting the ends between the points at which we've cut material out. And then on the other face of this bed of springs, we're actually inserting more material. We're elongating the springs. Then what's going to happen is on the face where we removed material, that face is going to contract. And on the face where we inserted material, that face is going to expand. And the net result is you get a bent structure in order to accommodate that contraction on one face and expansion on the other face.
And how does that differ from the work of others in building bent three-dimensional nanostructures from DNA?
I would say, to my knowledge, nobody else has created continuously curving structures. What people have done in the past is created kinked structures. And, well, it's actually a little more complicated. So there's curvature along different axes. So, for example, our earlier work from this year, there what we're doing is we can curve the DNA helices basically along the helical axis. So we can still build with a bunch of parallel straight double helices, but we can just array them in a way that we create a curve. But it's useful to be able to bend along the perpendicular axis as well. And that's something that nobody's been able to do, at least in terms of creating continuous curvature. The only similar thing that other groups have done is to create a kinked structure, where you imagine, let's say you have an array or a bundle of these parallel double helices, and then you connect it to another bundle through a sharp bending angle. And one immediate disadvantage or limitation of the way that people have done this in the past is that they don't have good control over the angle of that kink. For technical reasons, it's hard to control that on the nanoscale. And the only way that they can get any measure of control is through some kind of global triangulation. So, for example, there was a DNA box that was recently reported in Nature back in May. And there, if you have a bunch of solid walls, if you have six solid squares, and then the junctions between the squares, you're connecting them with flexible hinges, then if you connected them into a continuous box, then in that state, the structure would have some integrity. But if you only connected two of those faces together, then you could see that is floppy. So the advantage of continuous curvature is that you can have much more control over individual junctions between different faces.
What's the smallest radius of continuous curvature that you and your team have achieved in bending these lattices of DNA?
Yeah, so the smallest radius of curvature that we were able to obtain is 6 nanometers.
And how does that compare with the radius of curvature in tightly wound DNA in the nuclei of cells?
So within nucleosomes, the DNA within the nucleus oftentimes is packaged in particles called nucleosomes, where you have DNA on the order of 150 base pairs wrapped twice around a protein core. And there you have a radius of curvature of about 4.5 nanometers. So we're getting quite close to the radius of curvature of tightly bent DNA found in nature.
4.5 as compared with 6.
That's right.
That you've got. Okay. And your method requires no proteins at all. Is that right?
That's right.
At what rate were there defects? How stable are these structures?
So that depends on the architecture. In general, with these multi-layered structures, the yield that we get might be on the order of, let's say, 25 to 50% of the particles fold about correctly, just to start. And then if we now add on curvature, then the yield can go down a bit. So with the structures that are very tightly bent, then the folding yield might drop by another factor of 2.
Is it possible that the imaging technique that you and your team used to see these structures altered their twist or curvature?
That's possible.
So any observed defect lattices could, in fact, not be defects, but a result of the imaging technique?
I think that's an interesting question, and we don't have a really good answer, but we do have some independent measures outside of imaging that tells us that we're definitely getting defects.
How about
there might be additional heterogeneity imposed by the imaging. We can't be sure about that.
How about stability? Once you do have a good bend or twist, how stable is this?
As far as we can tell, at room temperature, they seem to be quite intact. If we just leave them on our bench or in the refrigerator for months, we can't really detect any difference. We haven't looked specifically at these structures in terms of thermal stability, but with some other ones, it seems like once you go above 60 degrees centigrade, then things really start going haywire. But oftentimes, up to about 60 degrees, they more or less maintain their structural integrity.
So next steps then are to reduce the defects and possibly improve stability further?
Right. So I think, well, we have two more general goals. One is to try to increase the complexity of the structures that we can build. And the only way that we can do that is, as you mentioned, is we have to deal with this defect problem. And then the second goal that we have is to try to employ these for useful ends.
Are you pursuing a different method for making these 3D honeycomb structures or instead trying to refine the process of insertions and deletions? Controlling?
You mean to attack the defect problem?
Yes.
So what we're trying to explore right now is basically by analogy, if you build a house with not very good building materials, then you're going to end up with a not very strong house. And so we're thinking a lot about how we can improve our basic DNA building materials. The scaffold that we use for this DNA origami process is the 7,000 nucleotide genome of the M13 bacteriophage, the virus that infects bacteria. And this sequence, it seems to work okay, but it certainly was not evolved for us to use it towards this purpose. And so one of the beautiful things about DNA origami is that it seems to work with almost any sequence. But we think that if you really are interested in a good yield, then it's actually better to come up with a sequence that's more suited for DNA origami. So one thing that we're working on is trying to learn what other sequences we can use. We think we can get a better yield in that way. And the second approach along those lines is that all of the staple strands are produced with standard synthetic chemistry methods.
This is how you connect the DNA strands to one another.
That's right. So 50% of the material is produced by synthetic chemistry using a wonderful method called phosphoramidite chemistry. However, it's a really wonderful chemistry, but the DNA that you produce is chemically, it's pretty heterogeneous compared to enzymatically produced DNA. And we suspect that this chemical heterogeneity is causing problems in folding also. So we're investigating ways to generate enzymatically produced DNA, and we think that's going to help. And then another step is to try to explore there might be specific architectures that we build that behave a little bit better than others. So the first approximation, everything works, but some shapes that we build have a higher yield than others. And so we'll explore what kinds of shapes gives us slightly better yield. Because ultimately what we want to do is to hierarchically assemble these well-behaved building blocks into larger structures.
William Shi, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Robert.
William Shi from Harvard University is senior author of a paper on folding DNA into twisted and curved nanoscale shapes. Read the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. To test the toxicity of chemicals, scientists typically use animal tests, a well-established but slow and expensive technique that often isn't very conclusive about what dose of a drug or level of exposure to a chemical would be safe for people. In a special section on industrial chemistry in this week's Science, newswriter Eric Stockstead reports on how industry and regulators are embracing new technologies for toxicology screening that may speed up the process and reduce costs.
So there's a growing trend to develop and evaluate technologies that could be used to better assess how safe or dangerous a chemical might be. The reason people want to do that is because the current system, which involves predominantly animal tests, has a number of shortcomings.
What are those shortcomings?
The tests can be slow, they involve a lot of animals, they're expensive, and it's not always clear what they directly mean for human health.
That's because of the extrapolation that the scientists have to do?
There are all sorts of extrapolations you have to make from an animal test to humans. You have to account for body size. You have to account for the fact that infants or fetuses are usually more sensitive than adults. There are differences in the biology between rodents and humans. So there are a lot of uncertainties in going from an animal test to a statement of risk for humans.
So by better testing, you mean faster and less expensive. It's not that dangerous chemicals are actually making it out into consumer markets.
Dangerous depends in part on exposure, right? So when you say dangerous chemicals out on the market, well, dangerous depending on how much you're exposed to or what way you're exposed to it. So yeah, I mean, there are lots of dangerous chemicals out in the market. Formaldehyde is very common exposure, and that's dangerous. That was in the FEMA trailer. So FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. But we're not going to ban formaldehyde. You just want to be able to say, here's what you need to do to be safe when that chemical's in use, right? So there are examples of chemicals that have been taken off. DDT is an example of a chemical that's no longer allowed in the United States. And asbestos is another example of a chemical. But there are not many recent examples, and partly that's because we don't know as much as we'd like to. I mean, maybe there are dangerous chemicals out there that we need to take off the market. But one reason to push ahead on developing new technologies is to get a better idea of exactly how much of a hazard chemicals pose.
What's the alternative then? What are some of these new technologies?
There are a lot of technologies that are already being used by companies because chemical companies don't want to have a chemical taken off the market. That's hugely expensive. It's damaging to their reputation. So those companies themselves have an incentive not to develop a chemical that's really going to be a problem. So pesticide companies, pharmaceutical companies, there are many tools that they're already using to try and screen things out before they get to the point of doing animal tests. You can analyze the structure of a chemical and get signs that it might not be a good one to develop. But in the current system, animal tests still play a large role in doing a risk assessment of the chemicals to figure out how risky they might be and for whom and in what situation. We'd like to have more of those risk assessments done. If you could move to a system where the data were generated in a faster way and the data were considered to be more realistic, that would allow EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and companies to do many more assessments and do perhaps better assessments than they currently do. That's the big draw for pushing ahead. Ways of doing that would be testing human cells. Rather than testing a rodent or a rabbit, you would test actual human cells. So you'd be able to say, well, these are, to some extent, this is a human biology, this is human tissue that we're looking at. So you'd potentially have more confidence in that. Prototypes that are already being used are what's called high-throughput rapid cellular assays. So you have robots that are applying chemicals in a broad range of doses even in mixtures, to trays of cells, so you can see a lot of test results rapidly. Or you're doing genetic screens, so you can analyze what genes are being turned on or turned off when those cells are exposed to chemicals.
All this sounds expensive. Companies are the ones that are bearing the costs?
Well, animal testing is expensive, and for the most part, it is being done by companies. Some animal testing is done by federal agencies, which are trying to fill in gaps if they identify a chemical that they think is a public health concern. There's not enough data. They don't think there's enough data in the public domain. They also do animal testing.
Now, you said companies themselves will be interested in pushing for this change, and the Environmental Protection Agency is pushing for this change. Is anyone not pushing for this change in how this testing is done?
There's a pretty broad consensus that this kind of new system really would be valuable for everyone.
And the science is there to support that?
There's a lot of R&D that needs to be done. According to some estimates, it could take 1 to 2 decades to work out what's going on in cells, what signals you're looking for. It could take 1 to 2 decades and $1 billion or $2 of research to get to the point where we really know enough to understand what cellular signals are telling us in terms of toxicity.
In the meantime, does that mean the researchers will be doing both types of tests for a while? Or how else would they validate these new tests except by comparing them with the old tests, the animal studies?
It's going to be a long process before federal regulators are comfortable looking just at these new types of test results. So there'll be a lot of work to try and figure out what exactly you should be testing, because chemicals break down inside the human body, and sometimes those metabolites themselves can be dangerous. So you need to figure out, do you just test the chemical? Do you also test what it's broken down to? You'd have to figure out what kind of dose is meaningful, because adding a chemical to a cell is an entirely different situation than ingesting or breathing a chemical. And then you'd have to figure out, does the body have ways of coping with a chemical that a simple cell doesn't? So what's the impact of having a liver, of when the liver detoxifies a chemical? There are a lot of steps that you need to take to figure out whether a simple test of cells can reliably indicate what happens in a human. So until enough research is done that there really is confidence in what these new tests mean, there's still going to be animal testing, and that's going to remain the current standard for the foreseeable future.
Eric Stockstead, thank you very much.
Rob, it's good to talk with you again.
Science news writer Eric Stockstead on how industry and regulators are embracing new technologies for testing chemical toxicity. His report is part of a special section on industrial chemistry in this week's Science. Scientists first divided life into eukaryotes and prokaryotes, or cells with and without a nucleus, in the mid-1900s, when increasingly powerful microscopes allowed them to see the finer details of cells. Like most science, this increasing focus and characterization led to new questions, particularly about the evolution of the nucleus and other features of eukaryotic cells, such as mitochondria, the cell's energy producers, and their striking similarity to bacteria. As part of our Origin series celebrating the Year of Darwin, freelancer Carl Zimmer writes in this week's Science on the origin of eukaryotes. I spoke with Zimmer from his home office in Connecticut.
Besides the nucleus, there are a lot of differences between eukaryotes and prokaryotes. For example, we get our energy from mitochondria, and you won't find any prokaryotes that use mitochondria at all. Another difference is that we have a very complicated skeleton in our cells. And what it does is it snaps together into long filaments that give the cell structure. And the cell can actually take them apart and put them back together again. And in a sense, it's kind of like the blob from the science fiction movie. It can push out a lobe if it wants and crawl around. And the cell can also use these filaments to actually help it to swallow up smaller prey, like prokaryotes, for example. So there are just lots and lots of differences between eukaryotes and prokaryotes beyond the nucleus.
Does that imply that there's some evolutionary missing link, some organism that had one or two of these main features you just mentioned?
Well, certainly the divide between prokaryotes and eukaryotes is a big one. I mean, there are some things that prokaryotes and eukaryotes have in common, They all use DNA, for example, and they use DNA to make proteins in much the same way. So you can see that they share a common ancestry. But figuring out exactly how they're related to each other is really complicated. So some people have said that, well, maybe eukaryotes evolved from one particular group of prokaryotes. If that was true, then it might be possible to find some prokaryote with a few of the features that eukaryotes have, an intermediate, as it were. I mean, this is something that paleontologists have been able to do with birds, for example. So they found feathered dinosaurs that couldn't fly but already had feathers. We don't have a feathered dinosaur for eukaryotes yet.
Is there any consensus about which of these features evolved first, the nucleus, mitochondria, molecular skeleton of the cell, and provided the organism the ability to compete and eventually gain these other features? Or do scientists think these differences evolved in parallel at the same time?
There are a number of different scenarios that scientists have been looking into. In one of them, the mitochondria evolves first, and then the other features gradually evolve after that. Other scientists have said, no, the mitochondria had to evolve late, and that actually some of the other features of the eukaryote cell, like a skeleton, had to evolve first. So there's still a lot of debate on that, on the actual order of events. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence that each side is marshaling to make their case. So it's still pretty unsettled.
How about the mitochondria itself? Is there any consensus about how it evolved?
Yeah, that, as I say in my article, is one of the really major advancements that has happened in our understanding of the evolution of eukaryotes. In the 1960s, Lynn Margulis of the University of Massachusetts argued that mitochondria hadn't just evolved through conventional natural selection. She said, no, mitochondria are actually bacteria. And the fact is that mitochondria have DNA inside of them, which they copy when they divide. Mitochondria also have membranes that bear a striking resemblance to bacterial membranes. And when scientists were finally able to look at the DNA of mitochondria, they discovered that they're a lot like one particular group of bacteria. They're not like our DNA. They're not really eukaryote DNA. They belong to bacteria. And another really important discovery about mitochondria had to do with some eukaryotes that didn't seem to have any mitochondria. So, for example, there's a eukaryote, a single-celled eukaryote called Giardia, which makes you sick with a horrible intestinal disease, and it doesn't have mitochondria as far as scientists can tell. But it turns out to have tiny little compartments that are now known as mitosomes that turn out to actually be the vestiges of mitochondria. So as far as scientists can tell, all eukaryotes either have mitochondria or the vestige of mitochondria. So that means that the common ancestor of all living eukaryotes already had mitochondria. So the bacteria that became mitochondria got inside of them by that point, very early on.
To the nucleus, then, under each of these different hypotheses, either the cell skeleton forming first or the mitochondria forming first in what is now the eukaryotic cell, do they have different ideas about how the nucleus formed, or are those the same under both scenarios?
Well, there have been a few different ideas about how the nucleus itself evolved, and I don't think there's any particularly good consensus yet. It's kind of confusing because there are lots and lots of proteins that form the nucleus, the sort of the wall around the nucleus, as it were, and they actually have a very confusing kind of ancestry. So some of the proteins seem to be related to certain kinds of prokaryotes, and others are related to proteins found in other prokaryotes. So there was something very complicated going on early in the history of eukaryotes that scientists are going to need a lot more time to figure out.
So what then is the idea behind the hypothesis that the molecular skeleton evolved first?
Well, some scientists have pointed out that the ability that eukaryotes have to swallow up other cells is actually pretty unusual. You don't see prokaryotes engulfing other prokaryotes. It actually takes some really intricate molecular systems to let that happen. So you have to wonder, well, if mitochondria are bacteria, they had to get into us somehow. And some people have speculated, well, some predatory cell swallowed up some bacteria, and instead of digesting it, the mitochondria then just became part of that cell, of that predatory cell. But that then leads to the question of how are you going to swallow up this mitochondria if you don't have the molecules necessary to do the swallowing? So some scientists have argued that before eukaryote cells took on mitochondria, they had to have evolved that ability to eat. And that means that they needed this new kind of skeleton in their cells. And they're starting to find some of the components of our skeleton, some proteins that make it up, in prokaryotes, or at least related versions. So there's starting to be a glimmer of figuring out exactly where our skeleton came from. So the big challenge would be to figure out, well, did the skeleton come first and then the mitochondria? Or maybe was it the other way around?
What will help close in more on the origin of eukaryotes and answering these questions, or at least help scientists come to consensus about which hypothesis is correct about how eukaryotes evolved?
Well, you have to bear in mind that this is stuff that happened a long, long, long time ago. The fossil record of eukaryotes goes back at least 2 billion years. We know that there were prokaryotes around about 3.5 billion years ago. So it's not easy to reconstruct molecular evolution that happened that long ago. And there may just be some parts of the story that we may never figure out. But that being said, there's still a whole lot that scientists can learn. And, you know, this question is driving them to do a lot of research, to get to understand the way that prokaryotes and eukaryotes work, to understand the molecules better. Not only that, but it's inspiring people to look out in the world for new species, for prokaryotes and eukaryotes that might have some really weird biology, things that we haven't seen before. I mean, maybe there is some intermediate out there, some prokaryote that has some of the components of a eukaryote that we just haven't found yet. But we know that there's a huge amount of diversity of microbes out there that we don't yet really understand. So just as paleontologists go out and look for more fossils, microbiologists are going to go out and look for more of these weird microbes.
Carl Zimmer, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Carl Zimmer writes on the origin of eukaryotes in This Week Science. You can find the whole series of Origins essays and a companion blog celebrating the year of Darwin at www.sciencemag.org/Darwin. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how happy the internet is. Dave, how do you tell the happiness of a network?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. And what you have to do, or at least what these researchers did, was they scanned over 2 million blogs and over 200,000 song lyrics that have been posted on the internet. And the reason they did this is they were trying to gauge the level, not really of how happy the internet is, but how happy society is. And it's actually a much harder question to answer than you would think because, you know, when psychologists want to figure out if one person or a small group of people is happy or sad, they'll hand out questionnaires or they'll conduct individual interviews. But you obviously can't do that with millions of people. So these guys said, well, let's turn to blogs and song lyrics. And the reason they chose those is because those tend to be outlets for personal expression on the internet, especially blogs. People are writing a lot about how they're feeling on a particular day. And with songs, they're, you know, also writing about their feelings. And the researchers also considered that these outlets would be more honest than a conversation with a psychologist because people wouldn't feel like they were being interviewed. They would sort of feel more open to discuss, you know, in a blog or a song lyric, maybe especially in a blog, how they really felt.
Still sort of a self-selected group, though, right? I mean, there must be some characteristics of bloggers that don't apply maybe to everybody else. I mean, they're affluent, they have money to be on the computer, they have time to be on the computer.
Well, it's a good point, Rob, and clearly this isn't a random sample of all of society. We are dealing with a specific segment here, but for the purposes of this study, this is really as close as researchers feel like they're going to get in terms of getting this really broad sample of feelings out there.
So how did the researchers get the feelings of all of these blogs and song lyrics?
Well, they utilized a site called wefeelfine.org, and this is a site that searches blogs across the internet for versions of the phrase, I feel. And so it looks for the phrase, I feel, and then it looks for the rest of the sentence. So maybe the sentence ends with, you know, I feel good or I feel terrible. And the researchers actually had about a list of 1,000 emotion words that they were specifically focused on, you know, and they ranked them from a score of 1 being miserable to 9 being ecstatic. So the words that got very high scores were words like triumphant and love. And words that got very low scores were words like disgusted.
So these are English-speaking blogs and song lyrics from around the world.
Around the world. And what the researchers found with the blogs is that there's good news with the blogosphere, and that is that the blogosphere has gotten significantly happier over the past 4 years. And the researchers scanned blogs back to 2005. So over the past 4 years, they've seen about a 4% uptick in happiness as measured by the happiness scores for the words that they're seeing in these blogs. So that's the good news. And they found interesting correlations with specific dates. So, you know, days like Christmas and Valentine's Day tended to have higher scores. And days like the September 11th anniversaries and most recently Michael Jackson's death tended to have lower scores. So they did see these correlations. And the happiest day that they found so far was November 4th, 2008, which was when Barack Obama was elected president of the U.S.
What about song lyrics?
Well, song lyrics actually showed the opposite trend. Song lyrics, and they went back to about 1960 with the song lyrics, have gotten much more negative, which is probably not a surprise to anybody who follows popular culture over the last 4 or 5 decades. What they found is that the highest scores they were seeing were around 1961. That's when they were seeing a lot of songs that had love in the lyrics. But starting around 1980, things started to get a lot more negative. They were seeing a lot more songs that had the words hate and pain in them. And they're saying that it's not really because there are any really different genres of music around now than there were then, although there were a few more. It's just that the genres that tend to be thought of as more negative, like, say, heavy metal or punk music, have just grown more popular. And so they're getting more representation in the popular culture, and you're seeing a lot sort of more of these quote-unquote negative lyrics. And the thought is that they're representing negative emotions.
What was the intention of the researchers in doing this? I imagine this kind of data would be very interesting, potentially, to marketers.
Well, there's some interesting correlations you can do with this data. For instance, do musicians with more positive lyrics sell more CDs? Or do people in countries with more positive bloggers live longer? Because there's been some correlation studies that have suggested that happier people tend to live longer. So there's some interesting correlations you can do here. And those are some points raised by an outside expert. But as far as the researchers themselves, they're interested in right now and moving on to Twitter, you know, the very popular social networking site. And the advantage of looking at Twitter versus looking at blogs is Twitter is even more immediate. So they can sort of track minute by minute happiness rather than looking, you know, even day by day. So it'll be interesting to see where this research goes.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from looking at levels of happiness around the world to looking at sensitivity to sugar and sweet taste around the world. Rob, this next study is about differences in our ability to taste sweet foods. And it turns out not everybody is the same.
Is this a nature or a nurture question?
Well, this is a nature question. It actually has to do with a gene called TAS1R3. And this is a gene that plays a major role in encoding a carbohydrate sweet taste receptor. So something that's very important for our ability to taste whether something is sugary or not. And for this study, researchers want to find out, do people of certain ancestry have more sensitivity to sugar than people of other types of ancestry? And so what they did was they took up 144 people from various ethnic backgrounds, and they gave them a bunch of sugar solutions. Some of these solutions had no sugar at all, and some of them were up to 4% sugar. And they had them taste all the solutions and say, how sweet does this taste to you? And right off the bat, they noticed a difference. They noticed that people that had European ancestry tended to view the sugary solutions as much more sugary or much more sweet tasting than people of, say, Asian ancestry or Middle Eastern ancestry or especially African ancestry. People with African ancestry tended to be the least sensitive to sugary taste. And the researchers correlated it to this gene, TAS1R3. And it turns out that there's these subtle genetic variations that are associated with these genes. And they found that people with European ancestry tended to have the most active form of the gene or variations that made the gene the most active. So in other words, making them much more sensitive to sugar than people with these other types of ancestry, which had genetic variations that seemed to make the gene less active.
What sort of evolutionary advantage would that confer?
Well, it's a good question, Rob. And the idea is, at least as proposed by these scientists, is that in tropical latitudes, there is much more sugary foods. And so you don't really need to have that sensitivity to sugar because you're surrounded by sugar all the time. But in the more northern latitudes, these sugary foods or these sugary plants, plants with a lot of carbohydrates, are harder to come by. And so you really want to have that sensitivity. So if you run across a plant like that, you're going to know that this is a food you should consume because it has a lot of useful calories. At least, you know, that was the case, you know, many thousands of years ago. And the idea is that those sort of adaptations stuck in the genes. And so that even today, people with European ancestry still have that genetic legacy of having this higher sensitivity to sweet foods than people with, say, African ancestry.
Did the researchers test whether the sensitivity to sugar played out in other foods, or this was just in a sugary solution?
Right, it's just in a sugary solution in this study. And what are the applications to real life? Does this mean that, you know, say Europeans are less likely to put sugar in their coffee or less likely to put syrup on their pancakes? And that's still an open question. But one thing that's really important to realize with this research is that, first of all, genes only account for about half of our sugar sensitivity. There's a lot of other things that play roles, such as how old we are and the hormones that are circulating around in our bodies. And there's probably other genes as well that play a role in sugar sensitivity. So taken all together, just because this gene is saying that somebody has a high sensitivity to sugar, that's not the whole story.
Okay, so last story this week. What's this one about?
Well, Rob, from a sweet tooth to growing new teeth, and once they have fallen out, maybe if you've eaten too many sugary foods, this last story is about growing new teeth in mice.
From what?
Well, as you know, Rob, there's a lot of artificial options for us out there if we lose our teeth. You can have artificial teeth put in, you can have implants put in, you can have dental bridges put in, but nobody's really found a way to actually create a new tooth in our mouth de novo. And so the idea is using, you know, stem cells and using bioengineering, can researchers find a way to grow a new tooth in somebody's mouth? And what they did in this study was they worked with mice and they started with something called a tooth germ. And you can think of this as a very preliminary tooth. It's basically the cells that will eventually develop into a full-grown adult tooth. And there's two types of cells. There's what's called epithelial cells and mesenchymal cells. And what the researchers did was they took these tooth germs, they isolated these cell types out of them, then they recombined them with bioengineering, and they implanted them in the space left in a mouse mouth where a molar used to be. So they extracted a molar from a mouse and put this tooth germ in there.
Where do these cells originally come from?
The cells originally come from mouse embryos, so we're talking about very preliminary cells. But the idea with humans is you'd actually start with the patient's own stem cells. So the idea would be that, you know, Rob, if you lost a tooth, I would actually maybe be able to harvest some cells, potentially even from your skin, transform them into these very preliminary epithelial and mesenchymal cells and implant them into your mouth, and it would grow a new tooth. Well, they're not quite there yet, but they did show that in mice that the approach worked. After about 50 days, they saw these tooth germs form into what looked like real mouse teeth.
So they bonded with the jaw, they had nutrients provided to them, everything.
Right. So the teeth didn't just look like real teeth, they acted like real teeth. They formed all of the right nerve connections that they were supposed to form and all the other things that normal teeth do in the mouth rather than just sitting there. They actually seem to really be interacting with their environment like a normal tooth does.
So just as if the mouse hadn't lost the tooth at all.
Pretty much. I mean, these teeth, while they look right and they act right, they aren't exactly perfect. Some experts have pointed out that the cusps on the tooth aren't in the exact position they should be. And the crown widths and the patterning of the teeth aren't also exactly normal. And the researchers say these are minor points that they can sort of fix with further research. But it is a really big step in trying to get from no tooth to a real tooth.
So still some cell signaling things to work out.
Still a lot of basic biology to work out, yeah.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, a couple stories that we're looking into is solving the mystery of itch in humans. What makes us itch in the first place, and how related is itch to pain? It's been a big controversy in the neuroscience field, and there's some really interesting new findings coming on that. And then also a study that very closely mimics an Aesop fable, which is about how rooks can drop stones into water to catch worms. And for the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking into stories about Francis Collins, who's been nominated to be NIH director, and how that process is going. And we've also got a few items up about swine flu. Some new cases have shown up in Canadian pigs, and also some guidelines about when people should be vaccinated against the virus. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the August 7th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.